Obama was in Fairless Hills outside of Philadelphia yesterday visiting Gamesa Technology Corporation. That's a wind turbine manufacturing plant. He talked about the importance of energy independence, a theme he has promoted during his 2+ years in office. He reiterated his call for reducing oil imports and for ramping up wind and solar power to provide more of the nation's electricity. He said that while domestic oil production has increased, there isn't enough of that kind of oil to meet the country's needs. He called for a mix of energy sources, including coal and gas. Well, in this hour of Radio Times, we want to assess the viability of the major choices for powering this country. That does include oil, natural gas, nuclear, coal, wind, solar, and biofuels. And we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. John Byrne is the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy, also a distinguished professor of energy and climate policy at the University of Delaware. And John Byrne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have John Byrne?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
I'm right here.
That was a pregnant pause, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And Darren Samuelson also joins us. He's Politico's senior energy and environment reporter. And Darren Samuelson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good afternoon.
Or good morning, here in Philadelphia, anyway. Darren, how much closer are we to energy independence under the Obama administration?
Oh, I'd say we're probably around the same place that we were with the last several presidents who have made similar pitches. It's a common theme that you hear trying to reach energy independence, and it really kind of depends maybe on how you measure the numbers. The president last week did throw out that he wants to curb oil imports by a third over the next decade, and he's basing that off of where we were when he took office back in January of 2009, and I think we're in about the same place as we were back then. So, you know, we've got a ways to go. Foreign oil imports, obviously, the question is what country are you talking about? And you know, the United States gets the majority of its oil imports from the OPEC countries, but, you know, we also get a huge percentage from Canada and Mexico, our neighbors, which I think the president even said yesterday in Philadelphia, are friendly countries that, you know, we shouldn't be restricting or worried about.
And I do want to pick up on all of that. Let me get your analysis, John Byrne. As you look at energy independence in the United States, what do you see?
Well, I would agree with Darren's overall assessment. While it has been a featured goal of policy at the national level for quite some time, we really have not made significant inroads in that regard. And we are going to have to do something more significant both at the national and state and local levels if we're going to really achieve such a goal.
And what would that significant thing be?
Well, at this stage, I think we've got to start considering. I'm not sure that we've got the political will to do something like carbon pricing, which I do believe is one of the key things that will need to be done. But we certainly have enough support for setting clear targets and setting up markets for the promotion of energy conservation and renewable energy. Our states have led the way in this regard. We have 34 states that either voluntarily or by mandate require, as a condition of sale of electricity into their jurisdictions, that a clear percentage come from renewable energy sources. And we've got 17 states that have set up aggressive targets in the same way for reducing overall energy sales from conventional sources. So I think that both of those tools, which our states have pioneered, represent a platform that we could take now to the national level and begin setting those targets for the country.
Well, Darren, let me go back to you and talk about both a carbon. I assume when you say carbon pricing, you're talking about a carbon tax, John Byrne?
Either a carbon tax or a carbon cap and trade. I think cap and trade is probably the one that's been more discussed in the U.S., but either ends up putting a price on the emission of carbon, and so we've got to find a way to do that. I'm not sure we're ready to do it anytime soon, but we've got to find a way to do it.
Well, Darren, let me turn back to you, and I noticed the president rarely ever says the word cap and trade, and I wonder whether that's an issue that is dead or one that just no one wants to talk about.
Both. it's dead in the sense politically the president isn't proposing it anymore. He did and pushed for it for the first 2 years while the Democrats held control of Congress. But when it passed in the House, almost, June of 2009, but the Senate killed it effectively. There was nowhere near 60 votes, and now there are way fewer supporters of that approach here in this current Congress. The president has said that a cap-and-trade system, which you know, a market-friendly approach that's been used for air pollution reductions, is not something that he expects here for the next couple of years. I think he would need to win re-election to push that forward in another year. And then, of course, if he did, I think that he would need to find a new way of explaining it, because the Republicans have done a pretty effective job of calling it a tax. And when you label something a tax in this political environment, everybody goes running. And that's why a carbon tax is off the table, and why cap and trade, which the Republicans and many of them called it a cap and tax system, which, you know, there's some questions about whether that's legitimate or not, but you know, it's been effective politically.
Well, but wasn't this a popular idea even among Republicans not so long ago?
Yeah, but that's a different political environment than even today.
The world has changed. The world has changed.
Can I just mention, though, Marty, that
Jumper.
I think that while it has not been effective as a national policy option, we actually do have a considerable number of states that are using the tool. The so-called REGI states, Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative states, that stretch from Maine down through Maryland are using the tool, and there is also a West Coast initiative that is underway for this purpose, and Midwestern states are talking about implementing this tool as well. So I would agree with Darren that that's why I tried to say I'm not sure that we have the political will at the national level to push forward this tool, but that doesn't mean that the American people have turned against it. You can certainly see some evidence in these states where the tool is alive and is actually well-supported politically.
Let me talk to both of you, actually, about some of the ways that we do get our energy, and oil is a good place to begin. And, Darren, if I could toss a couple of questions from to you. As you said, we get most of our oil today from OPEC countries, and Canada, Mexico playing a much larger role. How dependent are we as a country on foreign oil?
A good amount. I mean, the president said it yesterday. I think we have 2% of the world's oil reserves here at home, and you know, if we were to go gung-ho, you know, we could potentially get up to 4 or 5% if we were to, you know, drill everywhere that we do have oil reserves. So there's no doubt we are dependent on the Middle East. We're dependent on Canada, Mexico, South America, and you know, it's going to be that way for the time to come. And you know, we've seen a big political debate explode in front of the president since the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year, where, you know, he pretty much just a couple of weeks before that he had agreed to start opening up oil drilling off of parts of the United States that really upset a lot of Floridians and East Coasters primarily. And then he had to pull right back after the oil spill and put a blanket moratorium on new and actually existing permitting in the Gulf of Mexico, stopping everything that was happening there. And that's only now just slowly starting to come back into operation, and the Republicans have been riding him pretty hard, saying, hey, let's get going, and you're hearing it also from Democrats down in Louisiana and that region as well, who, you know, it's part of the economic livelihood of that part of the country.
Indeed. Well, John Byrne, let me go back to you. From your perspective, do we have to figure out then how to wean ourselves not just off of foreign oil, but off of oil itself at some time in the future?
Yeah, I think actually, and on that score, the problem we have is fairly specific. Most of our oil use is in the transportation sector, and the question really is, are we willing to ride the sort of roller coaster of gasoline prices that we've seen over the last 10 years? Is that something that's really healthy for the American economy? I don't think so. And if businesses cannot plan because of spikes like this, then it seems to me that we've got to start looking at alternatives. And that, of course, is what's beginning to happen. The one that I think we need to explore much more fulsomely than we have and really does require national attention is the building up of a transit system that really is 21st century. Anybody who's had the privilege to travel in Asia recently or in Europe comes back with just unbelievable stories of what are truly fast rail opportunities, where a trip from New York to Washington, D.C., for example, would be an hour and a half rather than the three-plus hours on our fastest train. We really have to find a way to move toward public transit, and that will be part of a way in which we would wean ourselves off of oil. It's significant.
What about hybrid vehicles, plug-in electric vehicles? Do you see opportunities, possibilities there?
Yeah. In fact, the fastest growing segment in the vehicle passenger vehicle market is the shift to hybrids, and I think plug-in hybrids have a great deal of promise. I do think that this is part of a multi-dimensional policy package that we need. I just worry sometimes that Americans seem to focus only on our vehicles and don't understand that if we do that, we're going to get very small sort of incremental improvements on that problem of oil dependency, whereas if we ramp up public transit, we're going to get to the goal line much faster.
And Darren, that if there are more plug-ins and new technologies for cars, you also have to build in, I guess, the infrastructure to support a fleet of vehicles like that.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, you're talking about obviously more electricity that needs to be produced as well to meet that demand for plug-in automobiles. And California is a pretty good example of that. It's one place where the technology and the regulations have been put in place to try and get plug-in vehicles moving and an infrastructure in place to, you know, line the highway so you can travel from point A to point B, you know, long distances or longer than what, you know, if you're charging your car up and you wanted to go more than, you know, 100 miles in just a daily commute, you're going to be able to do that. And so it's an infrastructure issue, and you see it with a lot of legislative proposals out there trying to stimulate electric vehicle use that's one of the things that they're thinking about is, you know, replacing, not necessarily replacing the corner gas pumps, but certainly having that alternative of a place to, you know, plug in your car while you stop to get a cheeseburger.
And Darren, about a minute before our first break here, but what's the fate of a high-speed rail line?
It hasn't been so good in some parts of the country recently. It's been interesting with the changeover in governors in some states. In Florida, for example, the new governor down there said, I don't want the money for a high-speed rail line between, I believe it was Orlando and Tampa, and the governors up in the northeastern states said, I'll take the money to get it moving for the corridor here that's quite busy from D.C. up to Boston. So, you know, the president proposed a number of connection lines for, you know, the sort of the Shinkansen, the Japanese style of bullet train, and there are parts of the country that are moving forward, and then there are other parts that with these current, fiscal, quote-unquote, responsible governors, that they don't want the money.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And today in Radio Times, we asked John Byrne and Darren Samuelson to join us today in Radio Times to talk about where we get our energy, the pros and cons of our various energy sources. And that does include oil and natural gas, nuclear, coal, wind, solar, biofuels. Darren Samuelson is Politico Senior Energy and Environment Reporter. John Byrne is Director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy at the University of Delaware, where he's a Distinguished Professor of Energy and Climate Policy. And we want to hear from you. How would you like to power this country? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, Masterworks of the Dance. The Philadelphia Orchestra and the Pennsylvania Ballet join forces for Falla's The Three-Cornered Hat and Stravinsky's Pulcinella as part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. Tickets available online anytime or charge by phone at 215-893-1999. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Ballet Masterworks with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
She is a soul singer from the Bronx. He is a saxophonist from the island of Guadeloupe. But when they met, sparks flew, literally. Jacques Schwartz Barrett and Stephanie McKay on their album Rise Above. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Master of Science program in Instructional Technology Management at LaSalle University proudly supports WHYY. Applications are now being accepted for summer and fall classes. Learn skills to manage, design, build, administer, and evaluate multimedia and online e-learning projects in the workplace. Classes are delivered 100% online. Details and online application at lasalle.edu/ITM. lasalle.edu/ITM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about the pros and cons of where we get our energy and some of the politics as well. John Byrne and Darren Samuelson, our guests, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Darren, if I can go back to you, and I was reading about these coal sands in southern Canada and the plan of a pipeline across the United States from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico to, I guess, refine is it oil that comes from these coal sands? How does this work?
Yeah, that's right. It's a very good, useful form of oil that, you know, Canada is just sitting on immense resources in Alberta, and, you know, they've been performing out of there for a long time now, and the goal has been to try and get those down to, you know, the Gulf Coast refineries where there is all the infrastructure really in place to get that into the United States fuel supply and fuel mix. This pipeline needs State Department approval, and Hillary Clinton's team is reviewing it right now and hasn't yet said one way or another whether or not it's going to happen. I think the president was asked about this yesterday by a Canadian transplant who was at the event, and the president was pretty coy and said, "Look, I don't want to put my finger on the scale. I don't want it to be seen like I'm interfering in the science," which was, of course, one of the big criticisms of the Bush administration, was that people who didn't have science expertise were influencing these kinds of decisions. The environmental groups don't like the idea of these tar sands. They think that they're dirty in the production process and, of course, keeps the United States addicted to oil, and this would, you know, keep sort of that cycle going if the United States were to be able to tap into it. And, of course, there's other concerns about putting that pipeline through different parts of the United States, and I think it would kind of cut right through the heartland, through the Dakotas down south to Louisiana. So where do you put that pipeline? There's obviously tons of infrastructure already in place in the United States, and people have agreed to put pipelines of you know, immense variety, so I'm sure that could probably be overcome, but it's a matter of...
Interesting. Well, John Byrne, what do you think of tar sands?
Yeah, I'm not too sanguine about that option. I think the infrastructure costs are very large, and if we're going to spend that kind of money on infrastructure, I don't want to be a broken record on this, but if we're going to do that, I don't see why we wouldn't invest it first and foremost in something like high-speed rail. Also, I think the cost of this particular approach is going to be quite high, and we need to understand that if we go that route, we're going to have to commit to a fleet that will absorb that fuel, and we're going to have to commit to that absorption at a very high price at the pump. You really can't get that option to work if you're talking about moderately priced fuel. So.
John, let me go back to actually where the president was yesterday, this wind turbine plant just outside of Philadelphia. What promise do you see in wind? And then we'll get to solar. But what do you see in wind? And I think we get about 2% of our energy from, or perhaps it's electricity from, wind today.
Yeah, I think wind has achieved commercial viability. We do see a great deal, both in Europe and in the U.S., of use of this particular technology. It is plugged into the grid now. There are some issues of how you deal with grid needs in that regard, but those are solvable issues, and so I think the future is bright for the use of wind, both technology and as a resource. I would caution against measuring the percentage of an energy supply that comes from a particular fuel source, because that's usually sort of backward looking, if you will. We're using a percentage against what we have done in the past, and if you look at energy transitions, they tend to occur fairly quickly in 20 to 30 years, so 2% looks small when we are looking at an infrastructure that was built over the last 100 years, but that shift from 2% to a much higher percentage can happen in a very short period of time, a couple of decades, if we commit into a new direction.
Darren Samuelson, there was a lot of controversy about the Cape Wind Project in Nantucket Sound, but I know there's also a wind project along the Atlantic Ocean from, I think, the Virginia area up to New York. Do you think there is more political will or even economic interest in the development of wind?
I think that the political atmosphere for wind has definitely improved since the approval of Cape Wind. That was maybe a big symbolic gesture on the part of the administration to go ahead and approve that after, you know, years of controversy and fighting by local environmental groups. I think the Kennedys living there were not too thrilled about that, and you know, that sort of was seen as a hypocritical position given, you know, how environmentally you know, green they're known as. And so the approval there kind of sets the stage for wind off of the coast, and I think that, you know, the atmosphere around it has definitely improved. You see wind plants all across the country when you drive now in the United States, and just in the last 5 years, the percentage, while percentages can be you know, a little bit tricky to look at, but I think in 05 it was less than 0.4%, and if we're at 2% now, it's grown, you know, a tiny bit, but it's getting a foothold into the U.S. You know, energy grid, electricity grid. You know, there's a lot of things that the wind energy industry wants to get continued sustenance, including some of the same sort of tax breaks and tax benefits that you know, the other big guys have long gotten, whether it be oil, coal, or gas.
Well, and I noticed that this company in Fearless Hills outside of Philadelphia is a Spanish company. What does that tell us, Darren?
Spain is one of the big wind producers. I've been there before, and it's amazing to see how many, you know, turbines you see pretty much all across Europe. I mean, it's quite amazing. Germany as well, a huge producer of wind power. So a lot of countries are way ahead of us. I know the Chinese as well are a lot of the technology is coming from there now. It used to be you know, produced here in the United States, I think 10, 15, 20 years ago, and you know, a lot of that industry has instead developed in other parts of the world.
John Byrne, I know, and I don't want to spend the rest of the hour on wind, but I know people that love birds and care about fish, that they are in some ways critics of wind power. Can you mollify them?
Well, actually, I think they're valid concerns, and I think if we're going to have a new energy regime different from the one that we built in the 20th century, it's fair to ask that it have environmental performance that is above average rather than simply what we achieved with the old regime. But that said, I think that issues of this kind can be mediated. There's a very practical and, I think, very useful example in Atlantic City where the Sewer and Waste Authority put up wind turbines but worked with the local environmental community to monitor and make sure that concerns about bird kills and so on were satisfactorily addressed. And as a result, you now have a coalition that supports this. Both the business community supports very much those wind turbines, and the city supports it, and the environmental community supports it. So I don't think these are situations where it's one or the other, but you do need to build a stakeholder process where everybody gets involved and participates in the design of the project.
And that's John Byrne. He's the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy at the University of Delaware. Darren Samuelson, also with us, senior energy and environment reporter for Politico. And we are talking about where we get our energy, some of the pros and cons, some of the challenges as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to some of our callers, but I want to get to nuclear first. And if I could begin with you, John Byrne, we've all been watching and talking about what's been happening in Japan. Reports of an earthquake, a 7.4 earthquake today, and concerns about a tsunami. There are no reports of a tsunami yet. Nonetheless, obviously concerns about what's happening in Japan. What do you think the future of nuclear energy is in this country? We get about 20% of our, I know you don't like us to use those percentages, but we get about 20% of our energy from nuclear today.
Well, I'm not. I don't think that the future for nuclear power is a good one. We're certainly learning from the experience in Japan of the problems that would beset any society. Of course, that is such an extraordinary set of events. Still, if you consider that Japan has arguably the best emergency response disaster management system in the world, and the nuclear facilities could not, even with that best management, best practice condition, could not avoid some very serious problems. I just don't see why we would continue to build these very large-scale plants with high risk when we have so many other very low-cost options. We've talked about some of the renewables. Of course, energy conservation and efficiency can also be very important in a project, and I don't think that we've got a long ways to go before we will have exhausted opportunities to save energy. Typically, energy saved is around 4 cents a kilowatt hour, and even at the best performing nuclear plants, you're still somewhere around 8 cents a kilowatt hour. So I think we should be looking in a new direction, and I don't think nuclear power will be significant in our future.
Well, Darren, let me turn back to you. And you've written about the fact that there are, what, I think 5 reactors under construction, 16 in permitting stages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the renaissance for nuclear power has maybe a bit overused of a term, but you know, there were a number of incentives that Congress included in the 2005 energy law that President Bush signed, loan guarantees and some risk insurance, things that the industry wanted. And you know, a lot of political capital has been spent on you know, expanding nuclear power, especially by the Republicans. You know, they have been talking about building 100 new plants over the next decade. I think that a lot of that's pie in the sky. The economics are not really there for major construction. The permitting process is long. You know, for a company to decide that they really want to do this, they really got to want to do this. You are seeing a couple of new designs move forward, and even in the aftermath of Japan here in the last month, some of the talk up on the Hill has been, well, maybe we can figure out ways to do a little bit more smaller, you know, designs of reactors as opposed to the big ones that we know about. I don't get a sense that they're going to stop permitting, re-permitting the existing 104 nuclear reactors that are up, and you've seen a couple of those permits starting to move through the process even since Japan, some of the more controversial ones, even on the East Coast and out in Vermont and outside of New York City. So, you know, the administration, the president has said nuclear power is here to stay and is a significant share of our electricity resource. As for expanding it beyond 104 reactors, I think you're probably not going to see many more, but people were saying that even before Japan. I had an interview with John Rose, the CEO of Exelon, one of the biggest power companies in the country and the largest operator of nuclear power. Actually, Exelon Services, obviously, Philadelphia region and Chicago, Illinois as well, and he was saying, you know, that the economics weren't there for big new nuclear reactors. He applauded some of his CEO colleagues at some other companies that are going forward, but for him in the states that he works in, it's just not smart.
Well, and John Byrne, one of the selling points from some on nuclear was that it was green and that it didn't create greenhouse gases.
Yeah, I think the trade-offs in that argument are important to bear in mind. It's not clear on the carbon front what the net gain is, particularly if you compare any power plant technology against energy efficiency or conservation. Almost always they come out to be far better carbon reduction strategies than building new supply. But even so, you are trading off a series of other very serious problems, both technical and environmental, that you're going to have to risk in order to capture whatever might be a claimed carbon benefit. And as I say, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has looked at this carefully and has pretty much been agnostic about the ability of nuclear power to be a significant source of carbon reduction.
Well, that's interesting. Let me get, looks like Paolo from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. And Paolo, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about offset trading as regards energy systems and markets. There was a study done not too long ago by McKinsey. It's a consulting firm, a very large one, and very well respected, and very conservative. They're not environmentalists by any stretch of the imagination. And they did it on a sectoral basis, looking at each sector of the economy, showing what could be gained in terms of emission reduction. At what cost? And they just rank them as they go across the economy sector by sector. Some things you can do within a sector actually earn you money. For instance, if everyone would take transit to work, they'd save money and they'd reduce enormous amounts of carbon dioxide production and energy consumption. Other things cost you money to reduce carbon dioxide and reduce energy consumption. But nonetheless, if you do it sector by sector, as McKinsey does, and it's one of their early, it's in the executive summary of their report. You can look it up online. Everybody on who's listening to this can look it up online. We'll see that the net cost in terms of money to achieve greenhouse gas targets is zero. In other words, the amount it costs you over the economy is the same as the amount you save.
Well, Paula, let me just stop you there. You're talking about cap and trade. Are you saying that the cap and trade can work?
In terms of who's making the gain and who's making the cost. So what we need is reformed markets, and the process will actually go on its own. In other words, it's actually net positive income making.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, to be perfectly honest with you.
I'm making a comment about the fact that they say that offsets trading is a tax. It isn't a tax. It's an income source.
Okay.
It's not a tax. The
Fair
economy
enough.
Will become more efficient, and we will make money. We will actually improve our welfare.
The average
household income will go up.
Okay, I hear you. And Darren, do you have any thoughts about this? And you're down in Washington where this issue of cap and trade has been debated.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you're saying that the critics are winning the argument. We hear from Paulo a different argument.
Yeah, I think the critics won the argument. I remember that study. There were so many studies that came out when this was sort of on the front burner for Congress. And you know, the EPA and the Energy Information Administration and others definitely pointed out that the bills that were being debated at the time would be net winners. There would be some increased costs for certain segments of the economy that are people, I guess, percentiles, people who make less money and where an energy bill going up might impact them, and the legislation had pieces in it that would have sent direct rebate checks back to them to sort of offset what they were going to be experiencing. And then for companies, he's kind of talking about where companies would be looking for the least cost reductions, and that's certainly what cap and trade is all about. And energy efficiency is one of the things that a lot of companies, had they been forced to comply with cap and trade, would be forced to do. And I guess one very important point to point out here, we talk about the death of cap and trade and the cap and trade legislation. That's true. However, the Environmental Protection Agency, the branch of the government that deals with these issues, has the authority under the Clean Air Act, through a Supreme Court decision in 2007, to do kind of the exact, same set of regulations as Congress was debating over the last 2-3 years and decade, and they are moving forward under the Obama administration to do exactly that. They did fuel economy a couple of about a year and a half ago with a big landmark, first major set of fuel economy standards in decades that will be in place through 2016, and the president last week said that he's working on the next stage through 2025 to try and get up to 45 to 60 miles per gallon in cars and light trucks. And then the EPA has got regulations coming out for power plants and for petroleum refiners to try and force a lot of these same energy efficiency reductions and maybe even direct fuel changes that the cap and trade bill would do. And of course, those regulations are the hotbed of controversy. Yesterday, the Senate voted 50-50 to stop them, which wasn't enough. There wasn't a majority to stop them. And in about 2 hours, after we hang up here, I'm going to go run over to the House where they're going to actually vote to stop EPA. And while that vote will be a big symbolic, slap at the face of EPA and President Obama, it won't become law because the president is threatening to veto that bill, and
you've got the Supreme Court decision as well. I'm assuming. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Darren Samuelson and John Byrne. We are talking about where we get our energy, the pros and cons, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Chester County Hospital. Did you know that snoring or skipping the dentist could affect heart health? Chester County Hospital is offering an online cardiac risk assessment to help you understand risk factors. Online at chestercountyhospital.org.
On the next Fresh Air, sex, drugs, and sea slime. Ellen Prager describes the ocean's oddest creatures, their odd mating habits, and why these creatures matter. She's the former chief scientist at the world's only underwater research station. Also, Brian Carpenter talks about reinterpreting music of 1920s, Chicago, and Harlem. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Is the Obama administration looking to psychological profiling to deal with Muammar Gaddafi? Also, the crisis in Japan is affecting the supply of cars and gadgets. Could that mean a boon for manufacturing in the U.S.? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
supporting WHYY, PNC Arts Alive, a five-year, $5 million program of the PNC Foundation, supporting innovative arts programming with the goal of making the arts accessible to all. More at PNCArtsAlive.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about how and where and how we get our energy. And our guests are Darren Samuelson, Politico Senior Energy and Environment Reporter. John Byrne is Director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy at the University of Delaware, also a Distinguished Professor of Energy and Climate Policy. We do have a full bank of calls here, but John Byrne, I have a question for you about biofuels and the role that you think biofuels should play in our energy sources. Throwing into that question the fact that corn has been used, and corn, of course, is a crop that people eat. And I wonder how you look at biofuels.
Yeah, the biofuel issue, I think you have to be very careful about where we look for answers. And one of the key elements is what you just mentioned. Not only is it a food crop, and so we're making energy crop and food crop compete, but it also has serious implications for our soil quality and has serious implications for for water quality and water quantity. I think that the strategy that is going to be more effective on the bio side has less to do with simply burning a material that we've grown and look more at some of the new chemistry that is being considered to get a fuel from bioprocesses. That's further out. I don't think that that particular item is going to give us new opportunities in the next 5 to 8 years, but I think it's really worthy of investigation. On the other hand, I think we did make a mistake with the ethanol obligation, and it's very difficult to undo it now. There's a huge subsidy for that industry, and it's very, very difficult to step in and repeal that subsidy. But it's not helping us on the carbon front. Most of the estimates out there suggest that, if anything, we've increased carbon emissions from it, and it's not helping us really to get to that energy independent strategy in the transportation sector.
Let me throw one more energy option on the table to you, Darren, and then we will get back to our callers. And this is natural gas. And we're talking to you from Pennsylvania, where there is Marcellus Shale. What role do you see natural gas playing? And is there controversy even in Washington over this issue?
Yes, absolutely. There's controversy here on natural gas, and it's, you know, coming from the states. It's coming from Pennsylvania. It's coming from other parts of the country where, you know, this has really taken off in the last 3, 4, 5 years in terms of the development and the environmental pushback. Where's it going? I mean, you've got support from the president. He called natural gas a clean source of fuel, and it is certainly where we go if we were to start switching away from coal. And there's a lot of we haven't really talked about
that's
coal
true.
At all, but coal's 50%. That's the big daddy of all of our electricity sources, and natural gas is behind it around 20%. And you know, there's going to be a lot more push, especially as we see a lot of these air pollution regulations. There's a number of tough new air pollution regulations coming on the power industry right now, especially ones to try and stop mercury pollution. And so, you know, natural gas has taken off. The costs are low, and certainly that's driving the boom. The question is, what's the water impact? What's the environmental impact in these local communities? And, you know, the administration right now is trying to balance that. It's a tough balance, as it is with every energy resource. And the president last week said that Stephen Chu was in charge, the Secretary of the Energy Department, the guy who is credited maybe with coming up with the way of stopping the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, with reviewing the science here. He's a Nobel laureate cabinet secretary. What exactly are they going to do, though? I don't know about regulations. That's the big question. That's what the industry is waiting carefully and watching and lobbying to stop any new regulations, and just hoping that, you know, whatever comes out of the government, and there's a number of studies going on. The EPA has got one going right now on water quality that's going to take here the next year to wrap up. There's looking at how this is impacting federal lands out west, where, you know, a lot of the leases are as well. So the next year or two will be very telling in terms of what new federal regulations might come out that could either slow down the prospects for natural gas, or I don't know about stopping it altogether, but certainly putting some hurdles in the way.
John Byrne, we didn't talk about the big daddy of them all, which is coal. Is there such a thing as clean coal or cleaner coal?
Well, we've been trying to find that for roughly 40 years. It's one of the major elements in the R&D budget in the energy sector, and so far we haven't found anything that was viable in cost terms, and while it's still an option that I think will be investigated, I don't think it's something that's going to serve near-term needs. In contrast, something like solar energy, which is showing great promise, is, I think, much more likely to play a role in terms of new sources of energy. As Darren noted, with 50% of our power supply coming from coal, we're not going to not use that source for a good period of time into the future, but it is not competing well for new sources of supply in contrast with what is now the fastest growing source of new supply in the United States and, in fact, in the world, which is solar electricity.
That's interesting. Let me get Justin from Wyoming to join our conversation. And, Justin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, with respect to wind power, you know, I'm all for renewable resources, but sometimes I get a little frustrated with the real environmental impacts with wind, and that is it literally takes hundreds of square miles to produce just a few hundred megawatts of electricity. You know, the bird-bat mortality issue is somewhat of an issue, but I wish when folks focused on wind, they would discuss a lot more of the offshore stuff. Here in Wyoming, we're home to, you know, 50% of the Class 5 wind resources in the country, and it's a major footprint on our landscape.
And I know I've been to Wyoming. I know you have a lot of wind there as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's just I think the true impacts kind of get masked when people discuss it.
No, fair enough. John Byrne, can I toss that back to you?
Yeah, I think the caller raises an important point. There is a big footprint around wind, and you do need to consider how you develop that resource over time. I think it's an important and valuable resource. There are trade-offs in this, but I do think that it's going to have to compete both in terms of its environmental impact and its economics on along these lines. And one reason why you're seeing solar energy grow so fast in the United States is that its footprint, while large in that sense, like wind, the footprint that it's using is typically rooftop real estate, which doesn't have near the kind of controversy and problems that are raised when you have these very, very large wind farms in our western states.
Justin, thanks for the call. Let's see what Dory from Berks County has to say. And Dory, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been studying an alternative fuel source that's kind of unromantic in Stockholm, Sweden, and Germany for the last 30 years. They've been making methane digesting in Stockholm. They heat 40,000 homes and run their bus system off the methane from their own sewage treatment plants. And there's a lot of options that are out there. Right now, we're putting like 8 million tons of sewage sludge on farm fields when we could be using that as an alternative fuel source.
Well, that's
so methane's just one of the sources. There's biochar, there's plasma arc, there's a lot of things out there. And that's absolutely a renewable resource.
Fair enough. Dory, let me see what Darren Samuelson says. Darren?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of these, budding energy technologies. I've heard biochar, I've heard methane. Algae, you know, there are lots of entrepreneurs out there, and a lot of them really were banking on cap and trade to come back to it as a way to stimulate, the marketplace of new energy ideas and try and, you know, put some sort of a price that would bring, you know, some level playing field with all of these old historic energy technologies. You know, coal is at 50% for a reason, and oil produces a huge chunk of our transportation infrastructure for a reason, that these guys have been around for a long time, and the infrastructure and the tax codes and the laws and regulations were all put in place to help them, as opposed to some of these newer budding ideas. And a lot of these other countries have tried to advance more progressive energy regulations. She mentions Sweden. I mean, the European Union does have a cap on carbon emissions. They've had one for about 3 or 4 years now implemented, and it's just getting going, but I think that that's probably one of the reasons you're seeing a lot of those technologies forming in other parts of the world. Even China has recently, with its every year they come out with a new 5-year government plan, they have a carbon cap in place in China too now. So you know, a lot of other countries are moving forward faster than the United States on the regulatory front.
Dory, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And John Byrne, I have an email question for you. Patrick from Lindenwald says, the norm is to have a supply company with many subscribers because the source does a massive production of energy. Is there any thought of a distributed energy system where the source produces a smaller amount of energy but is local? The idea that you create, you know, a sort of a small local power company that takes care of a smaller segment of the population.
Well, actually, I think that's one of the better suggestions that's out there for us now. Distributed systems are fast-growing and offer a whole series of benefits to our communities that the traditional systems that we put in place over the last 100 years do not. They have the cardinal advantage also of not requiring nearly as much upfront capital cost in order for us to advance those. And so there is a lot of very good experimentation going on in the United States on this distributed energy option. Vermont is a leader in this regard. They formed a utility called the Efficiency Vermont Utility. We actually built off of that in Delaware with something called the Sustainable Energy Utility that is now also law in Washington, D.C. They have one. Actually, Philadelphia, through the office of the Mayor's Office of Sustainability, is looking at a sustainable energy authority that runs along the same lines. All of these options give you the ability to tap into a much greater number of options than the conventional centralized utility does at lower cost, and provide the ability for local communities to govern their energy futures. So I see a very bright opportunity for that. I often use the analogy, both in communications and in computation, that we used to have. There's probably not many that remember, but once upon a time when you wanted to run a computer program, you had a bin of index cards that you, IBM cards that you took to a central processor, and you came back the next day to get the results of your program. We went away from that centralized system to distributed, and it's much better for everybody. And the same thing is true in communication. We used to, landlines used to be the way to go, and now all the growth is in the cell phone markets and so on, where you utilize distributed network systems rather than the old centralized. So I really think that is the energy future, and I think your caller has tapped into one of the most important questions about energy policy.
Patrick, thanks for that email. Let's see what Gary from Florida has to say. And Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
While I have some reservations with regards to food for fuel and the other biofuels that are being developed at this point, and great hopes for those to come online. In the meantime, I was wondering if by creating just a single fuel system for the public sector, specifically diesel, versus all the different blends that are out there, would that put a dent in any of the processes, considering you're just refining one fuel and one specific motor? Because it has been proven from, of course, from the work heavy hauling load and working vehicles all the way down to racing vehicles, would just creating one fuel, which of course biofuels will be able to help out when they come online, would that put a dent in anything?
Well, it's an interesting question. Let me see what Darren says. Darren, your thoughts?
John might have a little bit more expertise on this than I do. I mean, what I would maybe bring to it is, you know, the biofuels are an additive that goes into petroleum. You know, it's ethanol is been mandated through Congress to, you know, through the last 5 years, through the power of the corn lobby, through the power of the Midwestern states, to, you know, to get a strong toehold in and to being, you know, 10% of the mix of fuel that, you know, goes into what goes into your gas tank. And diesel is a complete alternative fuel, and I think there you're talking about you know, what kind of vehicles you're actually building and people are buying. Beyond that, I'd kick it to John.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think I'm not sure we're going to get a single fuel. I understand the point that the caller is trying to make, but I do think that diesel engines and diesel platforms have also a positive future, especially biodiesel. That's where the Europeans have actually bet a lot. Compared to the U.S., we are focusing less on the liquid fuel part, and they are, in their plug-ins and so on, they're still trying to figure out what that liquid fuel is that will be part of the overall platform of of a vehicle future. And so I do think that the combination of bio and diesel, not in the ethanol format, but in some of these newer technologies that I mentioned earlier on, I think we have some real opportunities there.
John Byrne, a final question for you, and you have mentioned this several times during the hour, the notion of conservation and energy efficiency, that we have to take that much more seriously. And how much savings do you think there is in that?
The estimates with the current technologies are that we can get at least 30% of our current energy demand served from energy efficiency. And one practical example, between now and 2030, we will revamp our national buildingscape. That is, through demolitions and new construction and things that we'll do to upgrade our buildings, we will make a big difference in what building stock we have. Why is that important? Because the majority of energy use in the United States is in buildings, and the estimates are that our buildings now waste somewhere between 30% and 50% of their energy that can be cost effectively less than the equivalent of 4 cents a kilowatt hour can be retrieved. And if we're to get from, we face a problem on the climate side where the planet came with the ability to cycle about 3.3 tons of carbon dioxide per person per year. The U.S. is over 20 tons. We can debate whatever we want to debate in Washington. The problem is that we are advancing a set of risks into the future if we don't deal with this. We can't get from 20 to 3.3 by simply supplying our way out. We have to affect the demand side significantly. And the good news is affecting it through new energy designs for buildings would save us between 30 and 50% of our energy.
Well, it's always good to end on a happy note. John Byrne, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Darren Samuelson, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls as well, even if I didn't understand them all. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.